From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
And I do think that scholars of women's literature and women's history have moved beyond the phase of saying, poor, oppressed women. Mm-hmm. Look how religion kept them in their parlors and kitchens and made their lives rigid, narrow, and horrible. It wasn't nearly that simple. It was a lot more interesting. In many ways, it was a liberating, enlarging influence, especially for writers. I have found, even for my obscure women hymnists.
Welcome to Soundings, Women, Poetry, and Hymnody in 19th Century America. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guest is a scholar from Pennsylvania State University. Mary DeYoung recently completed a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, where she worked on a forthcoming book entitled Heart Songs and Hymns, Hymnody and Power in 19th Century America. Mary DeYoung, you come to the Humanities Center from Pennsylvania State University. You're writing a book about, several topics, poetry, religion, women in the 19th century. Tell me what you're up to.
I'm studying hymns, or rather poems that came into use as hymns, and I'm concentrating on the ones written by women for a couple of reasons. One being that not much has been done with women's religious poetry. There's been quite a bit of scholarship in recent years in women's fiction, but women's religious poetry, and there's a great deal of it, hasn't mm-hmm. had a lot of critical attention today.
Why is it important? The sort of big so what question here. What inspires you to write a book about women and religion and poetry in the 19th century?
I was led into it by reading contemporary, that is 19th century criticism, where the consistent assumption is that women's poetry comes from the heart, that it expresses their experience, their emotion, that women's poetry is essentially autobiographical, whereas fiction is generally regarded as having an admixture of fiction. It is partly imaginative writing, but women's poetry is considered to be straight from the heart. Mm-hmm. So I thought reading it would be a good way to find out about women's experience, the way women thought about themselves, and in particular, their experience of religion mm-hmm. in 19th century America.
Well, let's pursue that just a little bit, Mary DeYoung. What do you have in mind when you talk about a reflection of women's experience? Are you talking about individuals, or are you speaking at the level of sort of extrapolating our national identity, trying to figure out how women and religion and poetry come together in such a way to teach us something about national culture in the 19th mm-hmm. century?
I would say both are involved. When mm-hmm. you can get at a rough draft or the first published copy of a woman's poem, it does tend to be very close to her unique experience as a human being and one who is a woman. When you look at the poems as they appear in anthologies and hymn books, then they've been subject to editing. And in some cases, you can tell that certain idiosyncrasies have been removed or personal details have been removed, and then it's more generic.
Mm-hmm. Who would have done the removing?
In the case of the hymn books, it's nearly always clergymen. Uh-huh. When you find out who it was that compiled and edited hymn books, it's nearly always clergymen or a church-appointed group of deacons, elders. Very rarely do you see a woman involved in that. Uh-huh. So what you get in the hymn books is poems that have passed tests put to them by clergymen, mm-hmm. the editors.
And why would this have happened? Are we talking about doctrinal things? Are we talking about too much of an expression of what you termed feeling, sentiment or sentimentality? How do you account for this editing that went on?
I'll pick up the second part first. The Victorians were a lot more comfortable than we are with the expression of emotion. Mm-hmm. When you read the criticism, the literature of hymnody, the assumption is very strong that the texts are emotional expressions. So that isn't really a problem. Mm-hmm. But what you see sometimes in hymns written by women, there'll be a reference to a child or something personal.
And why would that be objectionable? Is that, I'm still a little confused as to why things about, for example, children and feeling would be left out, why these clergymen would do that.
The way I see it, when you're seeing a hymn text as something to be performed by the congregation, mm-hmm. then probably specifically female things would be edited out, although I have found that there are hymns about going to sea and going to war, mm-hmm. you know, male experience, that do end up in the hymn books.
Onward Christian Soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you can think of that as spiritual warfare, and yet everybody's social association with that text would be male. It's uh-huh. male experience, going to the Civil War, going to the Spanish-American War as a Christian soldier.
Uh-huh.
And the only way a woman could consider herself a Christian soldier would be sending food or making bandages or writing nice, comforting letters.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about the aesthetic dimension of what you're doing, Mary DeYoung. You're looking at women and religion and poetry in the 19th century. Is this material important to you from that standpoint? I'm thinking maybe I could put it to you specifically this way. We look at the poetry of a person like Emily Dickinson. Are there comparative or divergent elements here between what she wrote and the kinds of things that you're looking into?
Hers is much more critical and idiosyncratic, although mm-hmm. I must say some of her poems were used as hymns in the early 20th century, which might have horrified her. She read hymns like most New Englanders. She read the hymn book like a poetry anthology. Uh-huh. And some people have suggested that her meters are patterned on hymn meters. It may be true. It's clear, too, though, that she's sometimes parodying the form and the perspectives that you find in Orthodox hymns.
Uh-huh. She wasn't so much of a believer as she was, as you say, a critic. Do I have that right?
I think that's a valid way of putting it. Uh-huh. In one lyric, she speaks of God as that noted clergyman.
Uh-huh.
And there are a few texts where she parodies hymns by Isaac Watts.
Mm-hmm.
Isaac Watts, a British clergyman, wrote a great many hymns, including a book of hymns for children
right.
that were memorized by thousands of American children.
Uh-huh.
Louisa May Alcott, Harriet Beecher Stowe, as well as Emily Dickinson, mm-hmm. knew these poems, and Dickinson plays with the perspectives and the images sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mary DeYoung, tell me about what the religious ethos, the broad, pervasive dimension of the influence of religion in the 19th century as it touches on this topic of women who are writing hymns and hymnody. Was there a stronger sense of belief, for example, in that day compared to ours? Does that help you to account for what you're doing?
To start off with a simplistic generalization, our culture is far more secular than 19th century America was. The dominant culture was strongly influenced by evangelical Protestant values. Many people described 19th century religion as a religion of the heart,
mm-hmm.
which is certainly true. You see that assumption, that is, in the way hymns are talked about. The lyric comes from the heart. It's to be sung by people feelingly. You often see instructions at the beginning of the hymn book.
Mm-hmm.
Sing with the appropriate emotion for mm-hmm. the text. So people are communicating feelings when they perform the hymns.
Well, doesn't that persist into the 1980s, for example, in revival meetings and television evangelism, that sort of thing? Or is it more isolated for us today than it would have been in the 19th century?
A 19th century person would have had some difficulty avoiding evangelical hymns.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt if people tried to avoid them. They were popular songs of the time. If you look at old parlor song books, you'll find Nearer My God to Thee,
right.
My Jesus, I Love Thee, Jesus Loves Me. The latter was written by an American woman. It was part of the text mm-hmm. of a novel, but people liked it so much it was pulled out, it was set to a tune, and pretty soon translated into 70 languages.
Goodness.
It's probably the most famous poem in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I have noticed that in the many hymns portraying Christ as a gentle, loving, nurturant figure, there is somewhat more of a tendency for the poet to be female. But males, too, were writing poems like that and propagating them, and they were being selected by clergymen. So even though you can't tell a lot by looking at the sex of the poet, you do find the hymn books often propagating a cluster of values that was then associated with the female role mm-hmm. and femininity. Mm-hmm. I see the late 19th century outburst of the militaristic hymn as a sort of correction for that.
So you're not going to make distinctions among and between the poets or the poetesses themselves. Am I right about that? If you're looking, as it were, at a sort of, well, it's not a monolith, but it's generic. I think that's the word mm-hmm. that you used.
Well, there is a genre mm-hmm. known as hymn. So people who are consciously writing poems to be used as hymns generally follow a certain meter. They use expected, almost predictable images. Mm-hmm. There is a subset of hymns that I'm calling for the nonce literary hymns because they were written as personal statements mm-hmm. and then later appropriated for use as hymns. Mm-hmm. Now, many times these are simplified. For example, Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote a poem called Knocking, in which she describes Christ standing at the door seeking entrance to the human heart, symbolized by the door. This was picked up by the gospel hymn writers, and they dropped out a lot of the language and shortened the lines to mm-hmm. make it more easily singable.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have mentioned that women play an important role in hymnody in the 19th century in America. What about black people, for example? We have a rich and a wonderful inheritance in terms of gospel singing, beginning with field chants and field yells, that sort of thing. Is that an important element in your investigation?
As far as I know, at this point, they did not make their way into the hymn books. My reasoning at this point is that in the 19th century, most of the black gospel hymn was in the oral tradition.
Right.
I'm studying 41 hymn writers very closely, and they're all white. This sample I have is women whose poems recur, so you could consider them popular or successful. They're all white. They're mainly from the Northeast. Mm-hmm. But I think that's partly because most of the hymn books I have seen so far have been published in the North. Mm-hmm. I'm finding somewhat different writers involved as I see Southern hymn books.
Well, this absence of the black voice, so to speak, is that a grievance somehow or other that you want to redress in this book, or are you simply looking at what was and, mm-hmm. and criticizing it on its own terms?
I want to know how the system works, mm-hmm. How the poems got written, how they were selected and promulgated and made available to thousands of people. But I do want to be able to explain why the black text didn't show up. Mm-hmm. I think there being an oral tradition is what explains it.
Mm-hmm. Is your book, in any sense, an exercise in feminism? Or are you, again, redressing grievances here? The way women poets functioned, how they were edited, what got included, what got excluded, that sort of thing?
What we may see as basis for grievance probably was not seen as such by the women themselves. I think you can very accurately say that women's poems were appropriated for evangelical uses, but as far as I can tell, and what they say about their own discourse and the way it is promulgated, they are delighted when a poem of theirs is chosen, even mm-hmm. if it's heavily edited.
I see. So they're willing to live with that. Do you discuss it today in terms of our notions of what we call the literary canon? Again, what got left in and what got left out, that sort of thing.
The element of the issue of canonization is present when you look at hymn books because you find out there are two classes, and it almost correlates with social class. That uh-huh. is, the women I'm calling literary hymnists, like Harriet Beecher Stowe, will show up in denominationally approved, well-printed books to be used in the congregation.
In other words, there was a sort of top 40. And then,
oh, yes. Uh-huh. And it's a small, recurrent group. Mm-hmm. And it's very often names that you would recognize if you knew something about 19th century American literature. Much more obscure people are writing gospel hymns, which show up in cheap paperback hymn books that are published by the millions. Yep. And they're ephemeral, and only a hymnologist knows about those people and their poems anymore. Mm-hmm. It just passed away as taste changed.
Mm-hmm. Sort of journalism of hymnody.
Yeah, that works well.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about women, poetry, and hymnody in 19th century America. My guest is Mary DeYoung of Pennsylvania State University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Mary DeYoung worked on a forthcoming study entitled Heart Songs and Hymns, Hymnody and Power in 19th Century America. Mary DeYoung, give me some specific examples. Are there lines that spring to mind that you think are noteworthy, instructive from the standpoint of telling us what 19th century American religion was all about, or from the standpoint of poetry, a sort of an aesthetic dimension?
19th century hymns aren't particularly interesting aesthetically because there are formal constraints. Yeah. And generic expectations.
Yeah, you mentioned
that
this,
have
all the
to be met.
Business of meter and everything. Mm-hmm.
But they are interesting in terms of popularization of doctrine and the prescriptions they set up for proper behavior. One of the most popular American written hymns in the 19th century was More Love to Thee by a clergyman's wife, Elizabeth Payson Prentice. And the message of that poem is, I can't possibly be worthy of divine love and favor. I must abase myself. I must suffer gladly. In, I think, 12 lines, Elizabeth Payson Prentice stated the dominant ethic of self-sacrifice and self-abnegation, mm-hmm. which is often correlated with the female role, although not always. Mm-hmm. I recently found a hymn arranged for male voices, and the theme of that hymn was, I must yield myself. I must give up pride. I must be humble. So it was really, strictly speaking, an expectation of all evangelical Christians. Get rid of that ego, humble yourself, serve God and others. Mm-hmm. That is definitely the message of the hymns.
Yeah, and standing in direct counterpoint to what you call our far more secular sort of religious, is it possible to say a secular religious culture in the 1980s, or more secular and less religious? Are we on mm-hmm. the right track there?
Yeah, I think so. Religion just completely permeated the culture mm-hmm. and the consciousness of the 19th century in the way that it does not for many Americans today.
How do these hymns come to us in the 1980s? Are they? My sense is that some of them would still be present in the hymn books. Are they what sort of fragmented, isolated little flashings of what you find, you know, far more present in the 19th century?
You still see 19th century hymns in the hymn books in use today. It depends on the formality of the hymn book. Mm-hmm. For example, in the book used in the Episcopal Church, there are only a few gospel hymns, but you will see a lot of them still in Baptist and Methodist collections. Mm-hmm. And I found, talking to people about my subject, that people who never went to church regularly know a little bit about Fanny Crosby and some of her many thousands of hymns.
All right, now who is Fanny Crosby?
Okay, Fanny Crosby, 1820 to 1915, wrote as many as 9,000 hymns. Over half of them were published, and some of them are still pretty well known. Rescue the Perishing is hers. Safe in the Arms of Jesus. Down at the Cross Where My Savior Died. Mm-hmm. She was a popular songwriter of the day.
And would have been a household name to people in the 19th century.
Yeah, she was introduced to, I think, 4 presidents. Everybody, exaggerating just a little bit, everybody knew her. Mm-hmm. Everybody encouraged her. She was a national figure.
Mary DeYoung, we're talking about your book on hymnody in the 19th century. Let me grind a personal axe here for a moment. I'm interested in Nathaniel Hawthorne. I know that you are too. Hawthorne is noteworthy for what some of the critics have called the tension, the elements that combine head and heart in his fiction. Might that have something to do with what you're looking into with respect to women poets and hymnody in the 19th century?
Well, I believe it does. The women are considered the spokespersons for the heart, mm-hmm. especially women poets. And women's verse is nearly always presented as a personal, spontaneous outpouring. It's not considered art. It isn't a shaped discourse, but it is the language of the heart in mm-hmm. verbal form. Many of the critics and the women themselves claim that they don't revise. Now, the religious poets that I'm looking at quite often convey that a lyric just came to them, mm-hmm. and some will suggest that it was divinely inspired. They always avoid taking credit for the way the lyric comes out. It either uh-huh. comes directly from the heart or from a higher source.
Because it has to do with the feelings, with sentiment or sentimentality, does that make it any less worthwhile as you look at the work of these women poets?
Well, they think of it as being more worthwhile, and mm-hmm. I'm coming around to that way of thinking myself. You can read these texts as a kind of evidence of the experience of being female mm-hmm. in 19th century America, or being a religious woman, mm-hmm. at least.
At the same time, Mary DeYoung, can we say that what the men, the editors of these 19th century religious lyrics written by women, what they were doing, does that represent only the intellect, what Nathaniel Hawthorne would call the head in contrast to the heart?
What I see them trying to do is to make the texts generic. Because sometimes you'll see a woman's poem revealing that she is a mother. And that will be reworded slightly without changing the meter so that theoretically the speaker and the poem could be of either sex.
Well, was there a forced effort to make the narrative voice in these poems masculine or what, neutral, to stay deliberately away from this feminine perspective? Somehow, why is it suspect? I mean, if in the 19th century women are the paragons of virtue, the domestic presence, why would there be an effort to minimize that?
I think the editors are making an effort to make these lyrics universal, in the sense that anyone can sing them and be expressing his or her own experience. But one of the ironies of that is people who write about hymn texts always talk about them as personal statements, mm-hmm. subjective, autobiographical, mm-hmm. but then they turn right around and clean out, or let me rephrase it, they edit out some of the signs of femaleness. Uh-huh. Another irony is that many times they will leave in a text an address to brothers, Christian brothers. Now, universal brotherhood, I suppose that could apply to anyone, but when people are looking in their hymn books and singing to their Christian brothers, what are all the females who dominate the congregation supposed to be thinking and feeling?
Yeah, no sisterhood at the same time.
Practically never. A few texts that I've found that are specifically addressed to or about women are funeral poems.
Mm-hmm. Mary DeYoung, were these women who wrote poetry that became religious lyrics in the 19th century, were they necessarily apologetic about what they were doing?
In the cases where I've been able to find statements by the women themselves about their poetry, they generally account in some way for their writing. Some of them say their heart was overloaded with emotion that had to have utterance. Yeah. Utterance is a favorite word. Huh. Others, for example, Fanny Crosby and Harriet Beecher Stowe, will make a case that God has called them.
That makes it special.
In the religious sense, they have been called to be religious writers.
Uh-huh. Well, this is a reflection of what? A sort of an ongoing burden on the profession of authorship in the United States. You find a lot of people who are apologizing for doing what they're doing. Again, Hawthorne is one of these. Mary DeYoung, let's conclude our conversation. We've been talking about your forthcoming book about women and religion and poetry in 19th century America. Speak to a general audience. Why is this important? We'll sort of come full circle here. You're adding another dimension to our understanding of the 19th century. Elaborate on that for me a little bit.
One thing I hope to do is qualify, I think, a still prevalent stereotype of the Victorian lady as having time on her hands and being relegated pretty strictly to the domestic sphere. Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on how you define domestic sphere. What excites me about my work is that evangelical religion gave women a way to justify as religious and domestic, moving out into the world and getting involved with social and even political issues. Under the aegis of evangelical witnessing, they did a lot. They nursed, they wrote, they lectured, some of them. There were even some female preachers in the mm-hmm. first half of the 19th century. As long as you could justify in evangelical terms what you were doing, there was very little opposition. In fact, you got points for it from your clergymen, from other male authority mm-hmm. figures.
So my guess is that while some, feminist literary critics or thinkers today might be very critical of what went on in the 19th century, after a fashion, for lack of a better term, the women's movement today owes a debt to these female poets in the 19th century.
Yes, a good case can be made for that. And I do think that scholars of women's literature and women's history have moved beyond the phase of saying, poor, oppressed women. Mm-hmm. Look how religion kept them in their parlors and kitchens and made their lives rigid, narrow, and horrible. It wasn't nearly that simple. It was a lot more interesting. In many ways, it was a liberating, enlarging influence, especially for writers. I have found, even for my obscure women hymnists, they wrote other things. They were incredibly productive. I'm sure they got a lot of satisfaction out of this work. One woman, for example, known to hymnists for a single poem, I've just found out, wrote 9 400-page books.
Goodness.
So it was a form, to some extent, of self-expression, but I'm sure that they could justify it to themselves, the family, the world, as service toward God.
Mary DeYoung is a professor of English at Pennsylvania State University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Mary DeYoung worked on a forthcoming study entitled Heart Songs and Hymns, Hymnody and Power in 19th Century America. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Women, Poetry, and Hymnody, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, the topic will be literature and friendship. My guest will be Ronald Sharp, a professor of English at Kenyon College. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about women, religious poetry, and hymnody in 19th century America. Wayne's guest is Mary DeYoung of Pennsylvania State University. How did religious lyrics 100 years ago reveal not only prayer and praise, but cultural values as well? Hymnody and Power, some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.